Tanya Reinhardt, professor of linguistics and cultural studies at Tel Aviv University and the University of Utrecht, has for years been one of the most outspoken critics of the Israeli government's treatment of the Palestinians. She has a regular column in Israel's largest daily, Yediot Ahronot, and has had hundreds of articles published in international journals. Brian Atinsky spoke to her at her office at Tel Aviv University and discussed, among other issues, the historical background of negotiations between the Palestinians and Israelis, the current crisis, and ways to activate a sustainable and effective international movement against the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland.
Before we go into the specifics of the current crisis with the Al-Aqsa Intifada, if you could give us a little historical background about the history of Israeli-Palestinian negotiations and the Oslo Peace Accords and how that has led to the result of the current situation.
In fact, prior to Oslo, there has been a concept in, always the concept of the Israeli leading powers was something called Alon Plan, which was their plan for the territories, and this would leave the Palestinian between 50% and 60% of the land where the occupied territories where they can live, and the rest would be under Israeli control. That was presumably the left-wing labor plan. Another plan which is essentially identical was Sharon's plan for autonomy, that the question is what you do with the Palestinians living under occupation, and the proposal was autonomy. So they would get control over their civil life and municipality life, but all aspects will be held by Israel, and this is the plan proposed to them in Camp David. The Palestinians always rejected this plan because obviously autonomy you can give only over land you own, so, and this means they do not own the country. And what seemed to have happened in the eve of Oslo was that there was a real change in the Israeli conception, that they were willing to consider now a real withdrawal from the territories. The general conception, public perception of the events at the time was that the Israelis are now really willing to open a new page, really give up the occupation, give the Palestinians back their land, and open a new era of peace between two independent states. However, in practice, what happened immediately after Oslo was that instead Israel turned to execute the Alon and the autonomy plan. The Palestinians did not get control over any aspect of their life. They were, on the contrary, more and more land was confiscated. The settlements have doubled in number of settlers since Oslo. The Palestinians were isolated in enclaves which are surrounded by settlements and bypass roads, and both the Gaza and the West Bank were divided into areas where the Palestinians are closed and have no contact with each other or the outside world. So what has been executed is this new form of control, which is very similar to the apartheid in South Africa, where the blacks were given these Bantustans, where they seem to have their own police and their own local municipality administration, but they didn't have any control over their property, their land, or any rights also in the occupying country. So that was the pattern that emerged in Oslo.
Yeah. But isn't it true that over 90% of the Palestinians now live under full Palestinian control?
Control is not the question. The question is on how much of the land they live. And they live on 50% of their land, 50% of the West Bank, a third of Gaza Strip, and a half of the West Bank are not owned by the Palestinians. These are state lands, security areas, areas which are considered the periphery of the settlements. So what the real issue was the land and the water. They have no control on any of their basic assets.
Now, looking at the move to the Al-Aqsa Intifada and the breakdown of the so-called peace negotiations, I was looking at 2 days ago in Haaretz, and there was a statement which seems very common among Israelis and I think in the international community, and I quote, "Arafat was not content with the 97% of the territory of Judea and Samaria that Ehud Barak offered him. The process collapsed because the Arabs demanded the right of return of the refugees to Jaffa and Haifa." First thing, did Ehud Barak offer truly 97% of the territory of the West Bank and Gaza Strip? And secondly, is the right of return truly a real sticking point? Or is it a boogeyman that the Israeli government is putting in front of the Israelis to scare them from backing the peace process?
The fact about the Camp David proposal, the latest Camp David proposal of Barak, is that there's never been any document documenting what he offered. There isn't even a statement of him that he's willing to dismantle even a single settlement. These were all things that were declared as general intentions. The published plans that existed before spoke about, before Camp David, these we do have a document of Israeli plans, and that spoke about, that's Barak's plan that he offered when he entered office. 10% immediate annexation, these are the settlement blocks. 50% would be of the land would be under Palestinian control, and 40% of the land will be left for future negotiations. So this is what he was offering. The only concrete fact would be the annexation now of the 10%, and the rest, the situation will stay as is. The truth is that Arafat and the Palestinian negotiator cooperated with the impression that they were offered anything more than keeping the situation as is. And this is because over the years they have cooperated with anything that Israel has offered. They have turned during the years to be Israeli collaborators. Without them, it would not have been possible to deprive the Palestinian people of any rights, lands, and water. So they were accepting this, but the real condition that Barak put that was impossible for Arafat to accept was the condition that he gives up on what Israel calls Mount Temple, and for the Muslims, this is Al-Aqsa Mosque. This is something that was never in any negotiations before. In Israel never had demands. There were all kind of vague formulas about the statue of Al-Aqsa. And it was the first time that it was brought up. And that was the one thing which is now somehow being forgotten, which Arafat could not accept. So that's why the negotiations blew up. Next, Israel demanded that Arafat gives a public declaration of giving up the right of return. The Palestinian position prior to this was that what they want is at least a symbolic recognition in Israel's responsibility over the Palestinian Nakba, the exile and the loss of state. And they did not demand, if they have their own state, they did not demand real execution, but recognition. And the Israeli demand was of them to give up even the right itself. So that, in fact, turned out to be one other thing that could not be, Arafat could not accept now, and it could have been left open the way it was left open all the years. But now I should mention that all wars in history, all attacks in history, all acts of aggression always have exactly the same form. It's always you first have to prove that you are really interested in peace. No one wants peace more than you. No one offers your enemy more generous offers than you do. But the enemy is such that he would never accept your generous offers. So he always wants to threatens your mere existence. So whenever there is an attempt of escalation, it would be surrounded by a grand peace offer that would be rejected. Now, my own assessment of what happened in So my question is, why did Barak put these impossible demands, given that Arafat was willing to continue the cooperation and pretend the Palestinians are getting something? Why did Barak insist on blowing the process up? Why did he put these impossible demands that would lead to an explosion necessarily? And my feeling is that there has been, from the beginning of Oslo, two lines in the Israeli politics. So we spoke already about the Oslo line, the one that was led by Beilin, Yosef Beilin. And that was the idea of executing the Alon and the autonomy plan and finding some way of enlightened occupation, an occupation that will enable the occupied people to have some form of half-sane existence. But the army, from the beginning, the military sectors of the society, were opposed to this plan already from the beginning. And interestingly, the one that was then the chief of staff was Barak. And as chief of staff already, he expressed his opposition to this line. And if you think about the army's reason, what could it be? Poli rests on the assumption that even the most enlightened occupation eventually would not last if you give the people any sort of national organization, any sort of independent local institutions. Eventually, they are going to rebel and demand more. So as long as you don't crash the Palestinian identity or even the Palestinian people itself, you didn't have a long-term solution. What happened now when Barak came to power, it means the army came to power, and it's the army, it's the same army, it's a list of people that were Barak's close consultants in the army, and they had the chance to try the alternative. The alternative they have in mind actually is something you find openly in the Israeli discourse. They are all talking now about 48, about this is the second half of 48. It started with the army circles like Bugi Yaalon, but it's now also what Peres is saying, that this is, we have never been in such an existential situation and threat since 48. So what is the second half of 48? What was the first half of 48? That was the solution, the first generation of the Israeli political and military system found for the Israeli Palestinians. This is hundreds of thousands, between 800 and 1,000 and 1 million of Palestinians were exiled from their home and they had to leave. And the rest were locked in very small isolated enclaves. And during the first year, it was made clear that they cannot have any contact with each other, the use of the military rule. And the result is that the Palestinian Israelis, the Israeli Arab, have indeed lost their national identity. So there are now communities of Muslims and Christians and Druze and Galilee versus the Triangle area and so on. They are completely isolated, and that was the conception of 48.
And speaking of this, came up. It's very interesting in the Israeli rhetoric. I mean, daily Israeli use. There are Israeli Arabs, which include the Christians and the Muslim Israelis. Then there are Druze. Then there are Bedouins. And there's all these different breakdowns. But there's no such thing in the Israeli day-to-day speaking of Israeli Palestinians. They don't perceive them as Palestinians. And they try to separate out different groupings to not even include within the Arab grouping. It's a very interesting word. Can you maybe go on a little also about how and why that occurs?
That's indeed exactly the policy of Ben-Gurion, and then during the first years of Israel, that was the solution to the Israeli-Palestinian population. Those who you could not cause to leave, you cannot transfer them, they did not escape, had to be broken up as a national unity. So the isolation and the depicting them as a collection of unrelated minorities is the one thing that helps control them and that helps prevents them from getting organized and demanding their rights in a collective way. So you could see that this is really Israel's solution. That's how Israel views. That's one solution that proved itself in the past. It was accepted by the international community, and it worked, and it did manage to really break up Palestinian nationality in these areas where it was applied. So I believe that what they are trying to do is now execute the same plan. It starts with the goal is to get rid of as many Palestinians as you can, either by literal elimination with thousands of wounded and maimed people, and or by forced evacuation. So already they are being driven out from areas still in the territories, and hopefully with. If this process of pressure applies for a long time, they hope they would be able to cause the majority of the Palestinians to leave the territories, and for the rest they have the plan of how to isolate them. If you take this as the real aim of Israeli policy, it start being more clear why they are attacking the Palestinian Authority. Over the years, the authority cooperated and enabled this new system of ruling the territories, and were indeed the most loyal servants. They were really doing the security job for Israel. They were really catching and imprisoning and preventing all kind of opposition. So why do they now want to, why do they start assassination and gradual individual elimination of the leadership of the PLO? And of course, if you change your tactics and you want to turn the Palestinian people to a nation of refugees or isolated communities, then you have to break any form of existing leadership.
You were one of the major backers of the blank ballot for the past election between Barak and Sharon. There's a lot of talk with a lot of Israelis that maybe voted, usually Labor, and even American Jewish community, that the Israeli left that did vote blank ballot or refused to vote at all really have been shown to have made a huge error, because looking at now the way Sharon has been acting, that they say, you know, look, wouldn't it have been much better if Barak was in place? Look what Sharon is doing. I mean, how do you react to that statement?
The fact is that there's absolutely no difference between Barak and Sharon, and that was the basis of the claim, the call for blank ballot of abstaining in the elections. And in this case, it's obvious. Everything that Sharon is doing was started during Barak. The assassination policy, the closure, the starvation, the use of helicopters. The only one thing that Sharon did and Barak didn't is sending F-16, but the plan to send fighter jets against the Palestinians were announced during Barak as well. So there's nothing that Sharon is doing that Barak did not do, and all the plans that are executed are Barak's plan. And in fact, it's neither Sharon nor Barak as individuals who rule the country. What happened in Israel the last few years, in fact since the Barak got into power, is that the political system is completely controlled by the military system. So we have the army group, I can name the people, so it's Bugi Yaalon, Eiland, it's the security services, some other few, a group of top military people who are running the country, and it's very explicit in the media. They are instructing Sharon what to say when he goes to US. They are explaining their views of what should be now the political declarations about. And Barak and Sharon themselves belong to this group. They grew up in the army together. They think and view the same thing. They cooperated all.
I just want to interject a question. But isn't this also true of Rabin? Rabin was a general just as much as Barak and Sharon. How is the situation different than it was under Rabin?
Well, in my view, indeed, I called for a blank ballot also when Rabin was then assassinated. But when Peres went to replace him, I also called for blank ballot, because there is indeed no difference. Because they at the time, the right wing was also happy with the Oslo autonomy plan, and Netanyahu executed it just as Rabin did, because that was still the stage of the autonomy plan. Now when the army decided to kill Oslo and move to this elimination state, the state of 48, they also are in complete agreement. So it is completely clear that the two branches of power in Israel are doing the same thing. Now, of course, just as in the U.S., there would be little differences. For example, the education minister of the Likud, now in the present government, it manages to change more textbooks in high school than the previous government, Barak's government, tried. So it's true that there are, in the little areas of humanistic values in everyday life, there are differences between the two types of regimes. And the people that fill the positions are slightly different. And then our question is whether for these little bonuses we can get by supporting the power system, are we willing to sell our right to really determine in what matters? Because in the very big things that determine our future and existence, we are not given any choice. And now, at least after the last election, we know that there are 20% of Israeli citizens who did not vote, who abstained in various ways. And these are the people that say we are against both, right? So we know, given the conditions, we managed to build some sort of a political power. Of course, it's much more in the States where there is actually a candidate and a party, and so the political building is much more substantial than we just have thousands of abstainers that don't know each other. But given that this was the only choice, I think we did the right thing. To the previous question, the fact that they sit together in the government, you know, the Labour and Likud, so Sharon and Peres, is the greatest evidence, the biggest evidence that there is really no difference between what they are willing to do. So we don't, in the specific case of Israel, it's easy to see that the two platforms are identical.
Looking towards the situation now and how we can move it towards a mass protest against what's happening here. What I see in this country is there are some protests and there are groups of people that go and march with the Palestinians. But the interesting thing is it's a couple hundred people. It's the same 100 people that go to every protest. You did say that 20% of the population abstained. And it was just written in Idiot Achonot that in a poll, 62% of the Israeli population are for an immediate stoppage of any building of settlements, and even for the removal of settlements from the territories. How do we move this knowledge that there is a mass of people out there? How do we move them from backing while sitting on their couch at home to actively doing something about the situation?
The most significant thing that have been happening in the Israeli society, which doesn't get much attention, is the number of people who are avoiding in various ways being drafted, either for reserves or for normal military service. Only a small fraction of them declares itself as conscientious objectors, and even of those, not many of them are reported because they are not always sent to jail and the facts are being hidden. But the numbers of those who find ways to avoid serving is in the thousands. And that's the most significant form of political protest. Even if people do not state it as a political protest, if they just try to sneak away, it's still a political protest. So this is happening. Now, as for the other, of course, many of those who object to everything that's happening feel completely paralyzed, because we have to remember that we are working in conditions of almost military rule. The media is completely controlled by the army spokesman determine the propaganda line, and there's no independent media, and there's hardly any report of the protests, so people have no means to even know it, that they are not the only ones in Israel who object to what's happening, because they never hear a report of the many others who are doing things. So here you ask me what could be done more. I think one thing that could be done is not just by the Israeli left, who is doing what they can, but the question of the international community. Unlike the previous intifada, this intifada, the left in the world has been relatively silent. This reflects the success of media control. So the media today is completely controlled by the power system, and the left has in some sense collapsed as an organized body. But still there are all these groups in the world, like the Indie Media Group, both in the world and in Israel, and many other alternative groups, all these people working on the environment, the people who travel from Seattle to Prague. I believe that if these people would now stop and look and see that what's happening here in Israel is almost, it's on its way to a genocide. It's already ethnical cleansing, but on its way to a genocide. It's really taking a whole nation that was willing to recognize us, offered the hand to Israel for peace, and now we are just eliminating them, attacking them. And if the same people who are traveling to Prague and traveling elsewhere will say, now it's time to travel to save and protect the Palestinians. So there are already a group of internationals living in Israel, in the territories, and they are participating in that protest, and they do contribute to the certain amount of control of Israeli violence. If the Israeli left could get support and help from the international left, it would be much harder to ignore us. We will be more known, and eventually this is to stop them this time. Now, obviously not everybody can now pack and come to Israel and help us struggle here, but there's still lots to do, also from wherever people are. So the first thing I think is to really demand breaking this media control. People can demand from the local TV, local broadcasting. They can demand to get real information about what's happening in Israel. Of course, we have the alternative medias like Indie Media and so on that do this, but it's not enough. One thing is to demand real information. The other thing is everything that could be done, protests and vigils and raising consciousness. So, for example, the 8th of June has been declared by the Women's Coalition in Israel and many others as the day, International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinians. So there are already over 100 vigils organized all over the world, but we can have much more. So the left could just focus one more edition. One of the things that people are doing already over the world which eventually can be helpful is a consumer's boycott. Don't buy any Israeli products, just like the South Africa boycott. So all these things, if the left just takes the Palestinian issue, the issue of the Israeli oppression, as one of its issues of the present, we can really do a lot to stop this.
Okay, thank you very much.
This interview has been brought to you by the volunteers at the Independent Media Center of Israel. IMC Israel is part of the International Indie Media Organization, a collective of hundreds of journalists and activists offering grassroots, non-corporate coverage of major issues. IMC Israel can be visited on the internet at www.indiemedia.org.il.